Hello and welcome to Chalk Talk. Today we've got Nicholas Coleridge on the Big Bad Glossies.
Good afternoon, and thank you for that very generous introduction. I'm obviously conscious that most of you are accustomed at the Chalk Valley History Festival to listening to lectures on the fall of Berlin and the siege of Stalingrad. So the world of glossy magazines may feel like a bit of a souffle or a strawberry pavlova by comparison. But arguably, as a reflection of a changing world, as a recorder and sometimes initiator of shifts in society and aesthetics of trends and personalities and nuance, magazines frequently stand in the front line of history, or certainly in the second line. As historians, if you want to know what people were thinking about in the 1960s or the 70s or the 80s and what the world looked like and felt like during those decades, then the archives of Vogue and Harper's and Queen, House and Garden and Tatler, or Life magazine or Nova are good places to start. At our archive at Vogue House in Hanover Square, there are seldom fewer than a dozen historians at any one time working through the back issues, researching one subject or another. As Guy has said in his introduction, I've spent, actually, I think about the last 44 years working in the magazine industry. My timing has been very lucky because the 35 years from approximately the 1980s to the year 2015 will, I think, come to be seen by historians as the golden age of the glossies. These were years when the circulations and readerships of magazines grew by a factor of three or four, and profitability boomed. And with this new prosperity, editorial budgets expanded and staff numbers tripled and magazine titles went global. The top photographers like Mario Testino, Patrick de Marchelier, Stephen Meisel, Bruce Weber, Craig McDean, all were paid larger and larger retainers to work for us, running into millions of dollars a year before a single shot was fired, so to speak. And during that time, the cult of the supermodel, from Twiggy to Linda Evangelista, Christy Turlington, right through to Naomi Campbell, Kate Moss, Cara Delevingne and the rest, all exploded during that moment of publishing history that was the glossy years. Let me go back in time. British Vogue was launched in 1916 in the middle of the First World War, actually right in the middle of the Battle of the Somme. There was paper rationing at the time and also clothes rationing. On the face of it, it seems an almost insane moment to have launched a luxury fashion magazine. I would like to have been present at the board meeting when the decision was taken. Gentlemen, we have no paper to print it on and no clothes to photograph, but I urge you to launch Vogue, a fashion magazine. Those in favour? Prior to 1916, about 1,000 copies of American Vogue would be delivered to Britain each month, but German submarine and U-boat action sinking merchant ships made deliveries too hazardous, so a standalone British edition was founded. I am quite certain that the founding owners had no idea of what Vogue would become in Britain, the showcase for much of the most important photography of the next century, from Irving Penn and Cecil Beaton up the road, from Norman Parkinson and Bailey, and then right on through Snowden, Testino and Merton Marcus. Vogue is the magazine that most personalities and celebrities, and indeed royals, sit for. No other magazine has that pulling power. For a long period, five decades, until the Second World War, Vogue remained a relatively small enterprise. The circulation stood at around 10,000 copies a month. Always imaginatively and creatively photographed, it was nevertheless predominantly a trade title, aimed at dressmakers and read by a limited society audience. It was full of charming essays on how to choose a hat or how to hire a cook. There was no sense of reflecting the fashion industry because there was no such thing yet as a fashion industry. The models were, in the main, aristocratic or destined by their good looks to marry aristocrats. Condé Nast has always been a bit of a marriage market. Our staff make very classy wives, if anyone's still looking. The company, by the way, initially belonged to a man actually named Condé Nast, Mr. Condé Montrose Nast. He was French-American, and he lived in New York. And here is his great publishing mantra. He said, if you had a tray with 2 million needles on it and only 150,000 of these had gold tips, which you wanted, it would be an endless and costly process to weed them out. But if you could get a magnet that would draw only the gold ones, what a saving. And what he meant by this, actually, to decode it, is that he wanted to start magazines that would be read, I guess, by the rich, and that for advertisers, this would make a tremendous niche publication with minimum wastage. He owned Vogue and its sister titles until the mid-1950s, when it was sold to the Newhouse family of Staten Island, who still own the company today. Condé Nast is part of the largest privately owned media company in the world. The 20 billion Advance Media Group has no shareholders still, other than the Newhouse family. Vogue had a good Second World War. I love these fashion shoots by Cecil Beaton, taken in bombed out buildings, very often in churches. Vogue was full of them during the war, incredibly evocative and melancholy pictures with their fireplaces and cornices and tombs amidst the debris of the Blitz. Today, I feel sure that health and safety would never permit Cecil Beaton and a group of Vogue staff to photograph in a bomb site. The 50s produced some important work, but it was in the 60s that you see the first real stirrings of the magazine decades in terms of impact. Objectively, magazines, even in the 60s, remained a secondary media until the beginning of the 70s. Vogue was by now selling 50,000 copies, Queen, later Harper's and Queen, selling perhaps 25,000, Tatler selling 8,000. Michael Heseltine launched a magazine named Town, aimed at men. It was a trailblazer, well ahead of its time, and it ultimately failed. Nova, first published in 1965, was tremendously important and gave the whole industry a jolt. Beautifully designed, boldly designed, the first magazine to discuss taboo subjects like sex and the pill and abortion in a sophisticated way, and the first title to use creative white space and bold type. It must have been a wake-up call for Vogue and for Condé Nast at the time, because it stole our thunder for about 3 years. Jocelyn Stevens and Mark Boxer's magazine Queen in the 60s and early 70s was important too, and certainly from a personal point of view, the first title to intrigue and to inspire me. You can trace the DNA of Queen in the 60s right through to the glosses of the second millennium in design, in attitude, and in approach. The first glossy magazine that I ever opened was a copy of Harper's and Queen. I was 16 at the time, and I'd been sent home from school, and I was ill in bed, and I borrowed a copy from my mother, who was a subscriber. That first couple of hours with a glossy changed my life. I was mesmerized by the wit, by the blend of serious journalism with trivia, by the glamour of the fashion photography, by the sheen of the paper, by the gentle waft of fragrance from the advertiser's scent strips, by the punning headlines, by the understated snobbery. by the zeitgeist interrogating social commentary. All of these things I found spellbinding, and I knew in a heartbeat that I wanted to make a career, if I could, in glossy magazines. But I'm getting ahead of myself. I was convalescing in bed, a glossy mag virgin, touched for the very first time. And it occurred to me that if I could somehow write an article for this magazine and have it published, I might somehow enter this tantalizing through the Narnian wardrobe world that magazines seem to offer. So as my quarantine dragged on, I scratched out 1,500 words on the subject of how to survive teenage parties, then trudged the half mile to the post box at the end of our lane and sent it off, handwritten, how incredibly amateur, addressed to the editor. And lo and behold, they bought it and typed it and printed it, and the typography and the glossy paper made it look 10 times better, and I had a byline. And then I wrote about another dozen articles in quite quick succession after that. By the time I left Cambridge, I knew that I wanted to work in glossy magazines. I was interviewed for a job on Tatler by Tina Brown at the terraced house in Pimlico she shared with her boyfriend, Sir Harry Evans, editor of the Sunday Times. Tina was not yet the world's second most famous magazine editor she was destined to become. I think we're going to give Anna Winter the prize for the most famous glossy magazine editor. But I'd been reading Tina's pieces for a long time in newspapers, and I admired her. The week I left university, I spotted in the Evening Standard her appointment as the new editor of Tatler, and I applied at once. We sat in her kitchen. Tina was 27, blonde, foxy, watchful. Spread on the table between us were 30 or so party photographs taken at the recent 18th birthday party of the Duke of Rutland's daughter Theresa Manners at Beaver Castle. Peering at the pictures through a loop, which is the technical term for a magnifying glass, Tina asked, "Do you know who any of these chinless characters are?" I admitted that I did and that I had been at that party. "I need a headline," she said. "Come on, quickly, it was a test. Something snappy." Saturday Night Beaver, I was hired on the spot. Note, the headline, Saturday Night Beaver, is a near-perfect example of early 80s glossy magazine wit, being both a pun on the recent film subtitle, Saturday Night Fever, and deliciously excluding only in-the-know readers who realise Beaver Castle is pronounced Beaver and not Belvoir would even get the joke. So at least half of the paying audience would miss it. And the in-crowd feels smug, which was at the time the implicit editorial mission of the magazine. Tina was wisely conducting her interviews at home, thus preventing applicants from encountering the Tatler offices until it was already too late. Lurking behind an impressive heritage address at 15 Berkeley Street, a stone's throw from the Ritz, were offices of unmatched decrepitude. You went up to the fourth floor in a jerking pre-war lift with brass gates, walked up a further flight, passed an office of a debt-collecting agency, and entered the tiny, sloping catacomb that was Tatler's global headquarters. You did not need to be Sherlock Holmes to realise that magazine was on the edge of bankruptcy and probably wouldn't last until the end of the week. Tina occupied a windowless editor's office at the back. The other 12 of us hunkered down at a mishmash of Edwardian school desks with antique Bakelite telephones and 40-year-old editions of Debrett and Who's Who. The magazine had been fighting for survival ever since it had been launched in 1709 by the Irish playwright Richard Steele in a St. James's coffee house. Every previous proprietor, bar none, had lost money year after year, century after century, until they gave up the fight and sold it. Successions of landowners, industrialists and social climbers, often all three, all had a crack at being the owner. Perhaps they reckoned there was some social cachet attached to being the publisher and owner of the Tatler, though looking around the offices, it was impossible to say what. On my first morning there, a photographer from the Evening Standard, my goodness, why are we several pictures behind? Because I haven't been pressing it hard enough. On my first morning in Berkeley Street, a photographer from the Evening Standard arrived to take pictures of Tina's new team. We were a ramshackle bunch. Tina herself, glamorous in the front. Georgina Howell, fresh out of Vogue, standing bird-like and anxious at her side. Michael Roberts, the louche black fashion director, with a cynical glint in his eye. And on the left, someone looking oddly like an Arab terrorist with deep set eye sockets. A selection of adorable country sloans, journalistic deadbeats and borderline bonkers paste-up artists completed the troupe. Tina gave the assembled team her vision for the New York look Tatler. Out would go the photographs of galloping majors at point-to-points and hunt balls. Out would go the wedding photographs of pudding-faced Herefordshire debutantes. Also for the chop were pictures of glass-eyed backbench MPs at the annual parliamentarian tug of war, then an annual Tatler fixture, and anything else that was considered elderly, dowdy or staid. Instead, readers would be treated to sexy London it girls, philandering men about town, disgraced dukes, libidinous novelists, upwardly mobile hostesses. The new cast of characters would hover somewhere between the scurrilous end of Burke's Peerage and Nigel Dempster's The Male Diary. It's an upper class comic. This, I just thought we'd like to see this great moment. Harvey Weinstein on the right, of course. Mick Jagger on the left, Tina Brown in the middle. Very classy group. After the painstaking fact-checked pieces that I used to write for Harper's, it was fun to speed-write articles for Tatler with buccaneering brio. Tina Brown had the shortest attention span of anyone I had ever met. She would commission an article and be thoroughly bored of it long before it was delivered. I learnt to deliver only on deadline, so she didn't become tired of it. She struck out everything that wasn't fun. In those days, I used to write articles of which I'm now actually, of course, incredibly embarrassed. Articles with names like Villa Bodies, the most comfortable and uncomfortable private holiday villas in the world. The owners of the so-called uncomfortable ones were enraged. You haven't even visited our villa in Corfu, they thundered entirely reasonably, and never will either. My second role was to sell the review copy books for cash. Tatler was sent numerous expensive art volumes, and these we augmented by ringing round the book publishers, pretending we were planning a big feature on the best new illustrated books. These would be couriered round to us on motorbikes. My job was to take them by taxi to a second-hand bookshop named D. Levin of Grape Street in Covent Garden, flog six large cartons of them, and then hand the £300 worth of cash to our restaurant critic, Julian Barnes, who would spend it having lunch in the Savoy Grill. My final task was to personally collect the monthly column of Margaret, Duchess of Argyll, who lived all alone in a rococo and chintz service flat in the Grosvenor House Hotel. She was still notorious as the protagonist in the 1963 Headless Man scandal, when she had, of course, been photographed through a keyhole, performing a sexual favour on an unnamed gentleman with an obscured face but visible dick in the drawing room of Inverara Castle. Tatler was rehabilitating her reputation by commissioning a social column of unparalleled drivel named Steppin' Out with the Duchess of Argyll. Each visit, I was made to sit alongside her on a sofa. Probably, actually, I don't think we see the sofa, but you get the general idea. While I copy-tasted her latest effort, her blind French poodle, Alphonse, who we can see, perched on the other side of me, snuffling. The Duchess sat disconcertingly close and liked to lean across me to ensure I'd fully appreciated some particular witticism, though the column was sadly short on them. Her claw-like hand rested on my knee. "One evening, when you have more time, we must drink cocktails together in this suite," she murmured. I worked in newspapers for a while before going to Harper's and Queen magazine, this time as its editor. The Harper's and Queen of the late 80s was fat with advertising, editorially coherent, and occupying a fertile space between Vogue on one side and Tatler on the other. Magazine DNAs are complex entities built up over many years, ultimately defined by the expectations of readers and non-readers alike, but accruing competences in related fields. So, Harper's and Queen was at its core a luxury and social magazine with acknowledged competence in fashion and beauty and a parallel proficiency in literary and intellectual matters. The trick was to keep all these disparate audiences in play at once. One was editing the magazine for the rich bitch Knightsbridge lady who lunched, for the Fulham and Parsons Green divorcee, for the country Sloane, for whom Harper's and Queen was often their last umbilical connection to metropolitan life, to boho literati, hardcore fashionistas, metrosexual cool cats, different groups finding within its pages entirely different pleasures and focusing only on the bits that interested them and quickly flicking over the rest. One reader, let us say, a 65-year-old Gloucestershire grandee, might have scanned Mrs. Kenwood's Jennifer's Diary, glanced at the decorating pages, at the horoscope, and a profile of a racehorse trainer, and felt well served. Another, a 27-year-old Ladbroke Grove singleton, might have connected with a Peter York style essay, or a Lloyd Grossman bar review, or a modern furniture shoot, and the fashion. It was the tension, and is always the tension in glossy magazines between these elements, which gives a magazine a sense of character and, one hopes, success. We spent much time in those days compiling composite articles with social punch but geographical reach. All magazines devote disproportionate space to London stories, since these tend to be shinier and more glamorous and happen under editorial noses. But half of the readers of Harper's and Queen lived outside the M25 beltway, so we would invent pieces with non-London strands. The 100 most beautiful women in Britain, the 100 most comfortable spare rooms in Britain, the 100 best connected people. The Barbara White's was number one, I think. What an absurd idea. Britain's top 25 life enhancers, the 50 coldest houses in Britain, with freezing bedrooms photographed brilliantly by Christopher Simon Sykes, with one bar electric fires in each one. These were deemed heartland pieces, reflecting the world of the core reader back upon themselves. It is striking how very little celebrity journalism we published in those days. No Hollywood front covers, no PR-driven interviews with LA film stars, no pre-approved questions or deals with publicists. All this would come later, I'm afraid. But for then, we were gloriously uncorrupted. I learnt that it was always the most unexpected articles which cause offence. The 100 most comfortable spare bedrooms in Britain was one such. I received a letter from one of the owners of one of the most comfortable 100 spare bedrooms in Britain, Lady Young of Grafham, wife of the Trade and Industry Secretary at the time, David Young. She sent me a blistering letter of complaint, citing unforgivable inaccuracies. "The bedroom wallpaper is not red with white stripes, as you state. the wallpaper is in fact white with red stripes. Furthermore, it is not a spare bedroom, it is a guest bedroom. I obtained a sample of the disputed wallpaper, and as it turned out, the red and white stripes were exactly and precisely the same width. We published a fulsome apology, which entertained all those who spotted it. I'd never passed through the revolving doors of Vogue House until the day I defected from Harper's to Condé Nast as editorial director and started work there. Our building is an early 50s construction, vaguely gymcrack, but with an impressive facade and entablature and long views across Hanover Square. Inside, the magazines occupy one floor each, with a distinctly different vibe to each one. As you move around the building, you feel shifts in culture, almost all of them conforming to stereotype. So Vogue rarely was populated by pin-thin fashionistas in black with killer heels. House and Garden employed Tory matrons and pretty Sloanes sifting through boxes of fabric samples. Most had grown up in old rectories in Gloucestershire and Wiltshire. Tatler was staffed by party-minded, treacherous socialites, brides by adorable, gentle young women who knew about wedding flowers. The world of interiors was art school bohemian. GQ floor, a testosterone-filled fug of sport and menswear and girly calendars and aftershave and business writers, and so on for several more stories. The managing director of the time was a tall, undeniably dashing figure in his late 50s with a military bearing. His days revolved around taking the company's biggest advertisers out to lunch at Mark's Club, Harry's Bar, and the East India Club in rotation. "It's good news you've joined," he said affably. "We're banking on you sorting out GQ. It's a bit of a shambles down there, actually." "Anything in particular you see as a problem on GQ?" He shrugged. "God knows, I don't read it. I'm not one of those, you see." He lowered his voice and gave me a meaningful nod. "Queers." It was decided I should be sent to New York for a month to live at the Pier Hotel and undergo a training course at the Condé Nast headquarters. I had been told to present myself on the first morning at the office of S.I. Newhouse, the man you can, in the left-hand picture, far right, the multi-billionaire owner of Condé Nast, but no specific time had been given to me to turn up in the morning. It was well known that Cy arrived at his office each morning at 4:30 a.m., which raised the question of what time I should present myself. I decided 6 a.m. would be appropriate, so I booked a wake-up call for 5 a.m. The sidewalks of New York were entirely deserted as I strolled the few blocks towards 350 Madison Avenue. I found Cy's office on the corporate floor and was ushered into the presence. Cy wore a grey sweatshirt and tracksuit suit bottoms. He must have been 60 at the time. He was one of the greatest collectors of modern art in America. Spread out on the floor of his office were 72 front covers of magazines, 3 years' worth of American Vogue and American Elle.
Nicholas, he said. "Good. I've been waiting for you to arrive."
He glanced at his watch, indicating mild dismay at my leisurely timekeeping. Attached to each cover, he had put in his own handwriting the number of copies that had been sold of each one.
"Can you deduce a pattern?" he asked me.
We stared down at the near identical images. The L covers in particular were absolutely identical. Close-ups of gummy, smiling blonde models with cover lines, your 563 fall essentials, etc. Cy said, "With numbers on the front cover, they always work best if they're uneven. You should never say the 1,000 best new summer coats. You should always say 1,021 best summer coats. If you say 1,000, it sounds made up," he argued. "If you say 1,021, they believe you." The following morning, I thought I'd better raise my game and arrived at the office at 5 a.m. The streets were full of stragglers heading home from the night before. A black jazz trumpeter swayed by, carrying his instrument.
Nicholas, good, I was waiting for you. I want to show you something.
The billionaire was sitting in this vast empty office. God, there were normally 5,000 people in there, only him and his PA. And he was manually counting the advertising pages of the new issues of American Vogue and the competitors. And on a yellow legal pad, he would write up to 10 and then do a line through them. And then he said,
"Do you do this, Nicholas? I find it helpful."
I said, "Well, I don't actually count them by hand. Our media research give them to me later in the day. Perhaps I should." He says,
"You should. You'll get them earlier."
There were probably three reasons why the magazine business took off so strongly in the late 80s. Partly economic, partly sociological. Economically, the rise of a more affluent society post-Margaret Thatcher had a direct effect upon advertising revenue. Ad volumes in Condé Nast in Britain grew from 2,500 pages a year to 12,000 pages a year. Across the group, we were soon booking 100,000 pages a year. And revenue passed $1 billion in Europe for the first time. Including America, we reached $2.5 billion. As the ad revenue grew, the magazines grew thicker in articles as well as in advertising. A September Vogue could easily, at that point, be 800 pages or 1,200 pages. London transformed as a city. Sloane Street and Bond Street were still packed with new designer labels previously unavailable: Chanel, Armani, Dolce & Gabbana, Gucci. Each one, as they came, started booking 400 or 500 ad pages with us a year. Companies like LVMH and Chanel became massively important to us, and I spent a large part of my life sucking up to them as a result. Simultaneously, the demand for magazines and circulations thrived. More people felt enfranchised as part of this world. The rise of the British High Street helped, Topshop, H&M, Zara, designer knockoffs, and the rise in celebrity. And importantly, we democratized the magazines too. They became less snobby and less excluding. In the early 1980s, if you joined Condé Nast as a new staff member, personnel would give you a form to fill in, and it used to say name, address, age, school, of course, no space or question about university, and, wait for it, private income. What did you get per month from your parents or from some trust? Diversity in those days meant Heathfield or Tudor Hall. All this changed, though not completely, since we still had space for deserving godchildren. But circulations grew. Vogue, which I think I last mentioned at 50,000, reached 220,000. GQ grew from 40,000 to 140,000. Tatler touched 100,000. Even House and Garden, so well established, reached 130,000. And we launched a whole slew of new magazines: Condé Nast Traveller, Vanity Fair, Glamour, Love, our technology magazine, Wired. And meanwhile, our competitors were doing exactly the same thing. Marie Claire, InStyle, Esquire, Hello, OK, all were launched during a 15-year period. And then we spun out our magazines around the world. We launched 100 new magazines between the late 1990s and the year 2010, and took on an additional 3,000 staff in Europe, until there were 20 editions of Vogue, including, as you can see here, Russia, China, and India. And it was completely fascinating how the recently liberated Soviet Russia and the liberated communist China took so immediately to the same formula for glossy magazines. Much of my own past 10 years has been spent in Terminal 5, heading to one market or another. I was briefly an Air Miles billionaire. Front covers for magazines are crucial. We spent hours at Vogue House trying to crack the enigma of the front cover. A good front cover can make a difference of 20 to 25% difference to sales at newsstand, and you felt that there ought to be an algorithm, a formula, to get it right every single time. The people working in our circulation department had a stack of old wives' tales, which they would pass down in the generations on what did and did not work. These included: blonde models outsell brunettes, smiley models outsell frowns, green covers never sell, models must have direct eye contact with the reader as they enter the newsagent, grey is a bad background cover, orange and red are the strongest logo colours, the list went on, unless every cover had an ultra-bright image of a blonde, grinning Claudia Schiffer staring directly out with a cherry red logo. The circulation department was full of foreboding. We held monthly cover meetings in my office with the various editors, displaying their wares to make these decisions. With magazines like House and Garden or Interiors or Condé Nast Traveller, it was tremendously easy, but because you had such a large choice to pick between. But with Vogue, Tatler, Vanity Fair, Glamour, GQ, which rely on celebrity covers, the choice was much more limited, and you generally only had different versions of the same celebrity to choose between. Circulation, by the way, unless you had Angelina Jolie, Beckham, who else did they like? Kate Moss, Cameron Diaz, they liked her a lot. They looked frightfully worried if you didn't. But what's so interesting is the people that you put on covers work for a while and then they don't. So somebody like Catherine Zeta-Jones would work for a while. Victoria Beckham worked for a while and then stops working. Naomi Campbell could go either way and so forth. These ones are all of the Princess of Wales. For a while, she was a banker. If you put her on, you could get a 35% uplift in sales. Sometimes, often, several of our magazines were stalking the same cover celebrities simultaneously. And this was very awkward always for me personally, since I was the only person who knew what was coming up. So Alexandra Shulman of Vogue would say, "Great news. We've got Keira Knightley for the August cover, Nick." And I would already know that Geordie Gregg had Keira Knightley on the July cover of Tatler, and Joe Elvin had her on the August cover of Glamour. And Dylan Jones was trying for a semi-naked Keira spread across a fur rug for the cover of GQ. And so I had to box clever and sometimes try and persuade one magazine to postpone or step down, though the celebrities always wanted to be on Vogue first. There were other painful lessons. Covers with male celebrities on a woman's magazine never sell, no exceptions. Even double covers, a man and a woman together, seldom perform. We expected We expected a Robbie Williams with Giselle duo to fly off the shelves, but it didn't. Same thing with a brilliant Elton John and Elizabeth Hurley cover, which we all adored, but which underperformed. Johnny Burrell from Razorlight with the Russian supermodel Natalia Vodanova didn't really work either. When asked their opinion, readers always say the same thing. They say, "Why are cover models so young? It's ridiculous. Why not put on some older women on your covers? Role models who've actually achieved something in their lives. I mean," they say, "I'm 45 and I'm your typical reader. I would like to see women I can refer to." But here is the weird thing. Whenever you put older women on magazines, they completely flop. The covers that actually sell show skinny, gorgeous superstars. Send for Kate Moss, send for Cara Delevingne. When the lift doors at Vogue House opened, it could be anyone inside. The Princess of Wales used to come in and out of Vogue House all the time in the 90s to borrow clothes. Kate Moss, processions of male models on their way to castings at GQ, interns collecting coffee, interior designers delivering lampshades to House and Garden. This was the daily traffic of the Vogue House lifts. Graydon Carter, the Vanity Fair editor, came to London regularly to visit our British edition, and we put on lunches and parties for him. I would try to lure a mix of actors and actresses and journalists and politicians and novelists to amuse him and generally generate some publicity. We were short of a woman for a boardroom lunch at Vogue House, and I thought we should invite the Princess Diana as a last-minute addition. She had recently separated from the Prince of Wales and was living alone in Kensington Palace. My driver, Brown, dropped a letter to the palace, handing it to the sentry box. Within minutes, she was on the line saying that she would most definitely love to come. The following day, a large photograph of the Princess of Wales appeared of her on the front page of the Daily Mirror. She was sunbathing topless on a balcony in Spain. The picture was so blurred and pixelated you couldn't see very much at all, but it caused a scandal and raised intrusion issues, and every columnist piled in, and I thought, damn it, she's sure to cancel. The lunch was the next day. Her private secretary rang to say she was still coming, but there should be no publicity, nothing. I must ring every guest and tell them and swear them to secrecy. The princess arrived looking fabulous. Looking at the photographs today, her blue suit with gold buttons has something of an Aeroflot air stewardess about it, but at the time it seemed perfect. She sat between Graydon and I and was very tactile. It was unexpected. I find that you could sit next to 1,000 women at lunches and actually no one touches you physically. But Diana touched your elbow and your arm and covered your hand with hers. It was incredibly alluring. And she was disarmingly confident, speaking without filter. She said, "Nicholas, can I ask you something? Please be truthful. Did you see the photograph of me in the Daily Mirror, the topless one?" Yes, Your Royal Highness, we do get all the newspapers in the office. I think I may have glanced at it. Not that I could see anything very much. She said, "William rang me from Eton, poor boy. He's only 14. He's very upset. He said some of the other boys in his year were teasing him because my tits are too small. Nicholas, please be frank. I want to know your real views. Are my breasts too small, do you think? I became breathless. I needed oxygen. I went as red as a guardsman's tunic. I stuttered, 'Are your Royal Highness, as much as I can see under that suit, they seem perfect to me. I wouldn't worry. Thank you. I knew you'd tell me the truth. I feel better now.' At the end of lunch, I walked into her car, which was waiting outside Vogue House. Suddenly, four paparazzi sprang forward, taking 1,000 snaps. In the pictures, as you can see, the princess looks radiant, and I look like her bodyguard or a stalker. It bugged me and embarrassed me that the photographers knew about the lunch. Which one of our guests had betrayed us? A mole on the Daily Mail picture desk supplied the answer. "Oh, Princess Diana rang us herself on the way to lunch. She always does that." Here are the seven editors of Vogue since 1940. I think the progression of their faces and their looks and their clothes says everything about the passage of time. The question that people always ask is, what is the future of print magazines? My instinct is this. In 30 years' time, there will still be successful print editions and versions of Vogue and Bazaar and Vanity Fair and House and Garden. The big brands with clear DNAs will survive, with a significant part of their circulation still in print. The smaller third-tier titles will cease publishing in print altogether and likely go under. Digital is already a central part of our lives in glossy publishing, as we seek to showcase the brands on every platform, web, mobile, Instagram, etc. Probably in 50 years' time, print magazines will be viewed as a curio, as arcane as hot metal printing or parchment. People will marvel. Do you realize they planted and cut down forests the size of Finland just to print glossy magazines on slivers of dead tree? They called it paper in those days, from the Egyptian word papyrus. But I feel very lucky to have spent my life toiling in the gloss machine while the going was good, and to have borne witness to this rather fascinating footnote to social history. Thank you.
Well, that's it for today, but there's plenty more for you to enjoy at cvhf.org.uk or wherever you get your podcasts. Thank you for listening.